We're going back in time this morning on The Conversation to the early days of retail stores in Hawaii. The move from plantation stores to small, independently run businesses was a gradual one. Plantation stores offered credit, and they were easy to get to, very important in the days before workers could afford cars. But as times changed, there was a rise in the so-called cash-and-carry stores. This morning, thanks to our partners at the Center for Oral History at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, we're going to hear from several people who opened stores on Maui in the 1930s. Mei Itamura dropped out of school in Kaheka when her father died. She went to work pumping gas in the 1920s. She then got a job as a store clerk and then a bookkeeper at Maui Dry Goods. She eventually was put in charge of the liquor department. She opened her own liquor store in 1937 and says she was the first woman to get a liquor license in Hawaii. She started out renting a tiny space, but that was just the beginning.
Oh, that I rented one small space right in Lopaia. Then after a while, I opened another one on this side.
Two. Did you feel sure that you were going to make good and make good money in your own business?
When I started? Mm-hmm. No, I wouldn't know because I heard this Maui Dry Goods main stockholder. He didn't want me to get the license because I'm a young girl and then nobody in Hawaii gets that license. And he said, I shouldn't get the license, see? Because I'm too young to run a store.
You're about 32 years old, yeah? Did you feel at that time that you were qualified?
Sure, I know what I'm doing. After I got the license, I didn't worry because I know I can run the store. That's the easy thing.
Were there other liquor stores in Lower Paia at that time when you started?
When I started, I don't think there was any except the Maui Dry Goods one. Mm. And then when the war came, there was a Japanese fellow that had a small liquor store, but he got closed down because he was alien, you see.
All the time during the war, the soldiers were allowed to buy liquor.
Yeah, but they didn't stay long though after that.
So you said that they would clean you out of your stock.
Yeah, one day's time.
One day, like yeah. How much gross would you make during the war?
I saw, I think the highest was 36,000.
In one day?
Yeah. Because cases by cases, you know.
So you said that you think you accomplished your goal in life.
Yeah.
So what was that goal?
Take good care of my own family, make them happy and help them. Put them through school as much as I can. At the same time, make some money, take care of myself. Because in this life, you have to be independent, you know. You don't want people to pass over you and, you know, oh, this old lady, we don't want to stay with her, but we have to take care of her and all that, you know. I think if you take care of yourself and know what you do in your life, you know, set one goal, then you'll get it somehow.
Mei Itamura, she got it done. The first woman in Hawaii to get a liquor license back in 1937 when she opened her own place, the Paia Liquor Store. Masakazu Shimoda was born on the plantation camp, camp number 6 in Pu'unene in 1911. His father founded Maui Shokai, one of the big five Japanese stores in Kahului. The clientele was mostly Filipino, kampong workers, who were paid only after their crops were harvested. Masakazu eventually took over operations of the store with his brothers, the business history that he knew well.
My father was the first to trust Filipino. See, we had Nihonjin Shokai, Onishi Shokai, then we had Ikeda, and then Paia Mercantile, Paia Nihonjin Shokai, they used to call it. That's five there, see? And with us, made six. So a lot of competition.
Five of you were all
in Kahului. Mm-hmm.
And you all sold the same type of merchandise?
Yeah, only we sold bicycles that were nobody sold. Then we sold RCA phonograph, which nobody sold. I think that's the only difference. Then we went into the Filipino business. We gave up Japanese, only a few handful of Japanese customers.
What did your father do to, you know, get the trust of the Filipino?
We had a good Filipino salesman. He's the one, not my father, the salesman. In those days, plantation had what you call a compound money. That's, you know, they take care of the field.
Every 2 years.
Yeah, they take care of the field by themselves. And then after harvest, if you have good tonnage, you make good money. Those people we have to carry. I know some of them we carry for about $900-$800 those days, you know.
So in 2 years' time, while they were waiting for their
gains, yeah, then we collected our money.
So sometimes the bill would be $800.
Oh, yeah, I remember for $800. They trusted that store so much, they put their life savings inside. Every payday put savings. So we had, just like the bank, passbook, keep the account, you know. That's why we could carry, you know, those people that every 2 years pay us. If not, we cannot carry. We had that extra cash to carry them along. You try to get a couple, maybe 50 people like that waiting for compound money, yeah? You can't pay the wholesaler in the end, you know.
Did the other stores like Ikeda and Kobayashi, did they do that kind of thing too?
Save money?
Yeah.
You mean people save? No, the Filipino, man. Japanese didn't have those savings accounts already. They would go to the bank, yeah? The newcomers, Filipinos. They would say, Maui Shoka is safer than the bank. My father said we had quite a sum of that Filipino money, you know, saved. But he said, not one they failed to pay back. He boasted, he said, we paid everybody, every cent.
Did you have many compound people not pay you?
No, most of them pay, compound people. They're about the most trustworthy, yeah? Because after all, you're carrying them for almost 2 years, yeah? Of course, if they're short of income, then you have to carry them for another 2 years. But if it wasn't for Filipino, I think maybe Maui Shokai gone already. Too much competition.
Masakazu Shimoto talking about the competition that would eventually be a factor when Maui Shokai closed its doors in 1973. When we come back, we'll hear a story that's not only about old-time retail in Hawaii, but also about immigration and the interaction between immigrants from different countries and different cultures. This is The Conversation on HPR One. We're listening to some oral histories this morning of early shopkeepers in Hawaii from the 1930s and 1940s. George Guerrero was an immigrant to Hawaii. He was born in the Philippines in 1909 in Ilocos Norte and came to Hawaii at age 17. He started working in a shop as a live-in clerk at the Nagatani store, then worked in a plantation store before opening up his own shop in 1946, running it for 24 years before he closed it in 1970.
When did you first think about working in a store?
I was encouraged by my friend who was working in the store. That changed my mind that I had to go, that I go and work in the store. And then he was explaining to me that you stay in the shade, the only thing you do is carry 100 pound rice, 100 pound of feed, you know. So he told me, I don't mind because I can do that. Stay in the shade, and he told me, rain or shine, you can work because you stay inside the store. That's why that encouraged me to go work.
What was the name of the store that you worked in?
That was Nagatani store in Waikapu, Wailuku.
Did you continue to live in the Punini camp while you worked in the store?
No, they had a house for me. They gave me the house where I was staying. I did not pay anything on my board, see, because I work. I just stay in that house, and then go eat in the store. They give me free food.
What made you decide to, you know, start your own business?
Well, at that time I was working in the plantation store. I know the prices of the wholesale, and I know the percentage of retail. So I was thinking, if I go make my store and I can sell so much, I know I can make it. Because I had been working hard in the plantation store. If I work hard the same way as I do, I should say, then I know I can make it. That's why it makes my mind that I try my luck to make my own business.
At that time, had a lot of plantation stores and then had a lot of Japanese-run stores. Yeah. What made you, did you think that you could get your percentage of customers?
Well, at the time, I know, because I told them that I could get plenty of them, because I told them the price that we sell in the store will be the same price I will sell you. You can compare, and if you don't want, well, it's up to you, but I greatly appreciate if you will patronize on me. So that'll, if the same price, no problem, we buy from you. So at that time, I have all different nationality. I have Filipinos, I have Japanese, I have Chinese, Hawaiian, all kind of ethnic.
All the way up until 1970, you
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever want your sons or daughters to continue the store?
I tried to convince them that one of them should carry over, but they said the hours that they're putting in there, they said it's too long, so they want to work only 8 hours and go home, and that's all.
George Guerrero, clearly not a man of 8-hour days. Neither was Sidney Kosasa. He was the person behind the ABC stores. This story is not from the plantations, and it's not from the 1930s either, but it's from urban Honolulu, and a bit later. Sidney Kosasa was born in the Palolo Valley, where his Japanese parents ran a grocery store. He worked there growing up, went on to study and work as a pharmacist, going to St. Louis in 1943, returning to Hawaii the following year to work at a local drugstore chain. In 1949, he opened Kaimuki Pharmacy on Wailea and eventually owned 8 drugstores on the island. In 1965, he went to a chain drugstore meeting in Florida and saw firsthand the business that convenience stores were doing with tourists. He came back to Honolulu and opened the first ABC store in Waikiki. By 1975, he had 7 of them. 10 years later, he had 27. When this interview was done with Sidney Kosasa in 2001, there were 60 ABC stores. He said the seeds of his future success were planted by his mother when he was still going to high school and working in the family grocery store.
And my mother is always she's a good businesswoman, see? Well, she says, you know, because there was Stewart Pharmacy and Hollister Drugstore on the Wailea Avenue. She says, hey, they make more money than the grocery stores, see? So she wants to take a pharmacy and open up a drugstore, see? So that's how she gave me that idea, see? So,
and how did you feel about that idea?
I thought that was pretty good, because I grew up in a grocery store, so know the business. See? So I said, well, working in a drugstore, all I do is take a pharmacy, you know, and get a pharmacy license, you could open a drugstore, you know. So then I kind of made up my mind that eventually I'll open up a drugstore, see.
How did you get the idea to start ABC?
When I went to this chain drug meeting in Miami, at that time, way back 1965, see, the big hotels were all in Miami. It was a little kind of a shopping mall in Miami, see. And yet, we noticed that, see, all the people, you know, all around there, they were going to the shopping area to go shop, see? So we figured, see, Waikiki, one of these days, going to have a lot of hotels around. And then, you know, we'll be able to look around for locations, so we'll anchor ourselves with our shops around there. And that's how we got started on it. So when we came back, she and I, we started looking all around Waikiki. There was hardly anybody around Waikiki. Only Hale Kulani was one of the Royal Hawaiian Hotel and Moana Hotel. That was the only hotel there. I figured, gee, how am I going to be one of these days like Miami? So when we started out with Health and Beauty. So that's what they say. ABC discount drugstore first. So the same thing counts as the drugstore too, you know, ABC drugstore. You know. Since we carry a lot of drugs and cosmetics, and of course we carry groceries and fast food, now we carry everything.
How did you come up with the name ABC?
Tourists that come from the mainland, from Japan, they cannot remember the Hawaiian name or anything. So why don't we pick up an easy name so that anybody can remember? So that's how we pick up ABC.
ABC founder Sidney Kosasa and the story of the naming of the ABC stores. Why do I think that's going to wind up as a backyard quiz someday? If you have a story about stores in Hawaii, any thoughts about what you just heard, you can give a call to our talkback line. Leave us a message. Number to call there, 808-792-8217. Our thanks, as always, to the Center for Oral History at the University of Hawaii, and mahalo nui to Daviana McGregor, Lurleen McGregor, and Micah Mizukami for all their work on this project and all our other collaborations.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bishop Museum's Spineless Wonders, Rising from the Deep, an exploration of marine invertebrates and the scientists behind their discovery. Now open. BishopMuseum.org.
One of the topics we often cover here at HPR is pedestrian safety. There are many aspects to that, depending on where you live, but there is one part that may surprise you, especially if you live on the island of Oahu. Our partners at Civil Beat have been looking into crosswalks, and specifically it turns out that in Honolulu, the city has been removing crosswalks in order to improve pedestrian safety. Marcel Honore has that story today. He joins us with more. And Marcel, there's a twist in this story that despite a lack of crosswalks, it's still legal to cross at those spots?
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of hard to get your head around some of the logic here, and I kind of try and lay it out in the story. But under state law, it is still legal at these crossings to cross even after the city removes the stripes, right, in these heavily trafficked areas. You know, it's deeming that these crossings, these pedestrian crossings, are not safe, and they could also open up the state to legal liability they could open the city up to legal liability if it's shown that they've looked at these crossings recently and they see that they don't meet the recent federal standards. So the response, by and large, has been to remove as many as 45 crosswalks. Or are slated to remove, either removed or plan to, these 45. The issue really at hand is that they're removing as opposed to enhancing and adding the necessary safety enhancements. It's kind of a confusing, complicated issue because even though they are removing those stripes, it's still legal to cross. And that's where you get situations like on Kapi'olani Boulevard. Some people might have noticed when you cross Makuli on Kapi'olani Boulevard near Alawa Community Park, there are still pedestrian crossing signs up at Willy Willy and Pa'ani. And there are curb cutouts or curb ramps for people to cross there, but there are no crosswalk stripes. And so it's very confusing, and you know there are advocates and residents in these neighborhoods that are saying this action is actually making things more unsafe in the long run for pedestrians.
Well, that's also, I mean, that's a real concern for pedestrians, but there's another perspective of this in terms of drivers, that if you're driving along and you don't see a crosswalk painted out there, you know, is the driver supposed to know that a crosswalk used to be in a particular location and therefore it's okay for people to cross?
Right. The big issue here is that drivers largely aren't aware that these are legal crossings. And so they don't have, you know, as drivers, we're used to those visual cues that say this is a crosswalk.
Right.
In essence, you know, removing the stripes does not solve the problem. And so really what the piece is looking at is whether, you know, more effort should be done to actually enhance these crossings rather than black out the crosswalk stripings.
You know, as you point out in the piece as well, of course, that's a very expensive undertaking. And again, this is sort of all in the context of simultaneously going on at the point where city and county taking a broader look at pedestrian safety about streets and all of the rest of that. And adding things such as the, if not rumble strips, but little bumps for, again, as you were saying, cues for the driver to slow down here or be careful. One aspect of your story that's great, you got a map here that indicates where they have removed or are considering removing. And it's a concentration seemingly on some very heavily trafficked areas.
That's right. You see a lot on King Street in particular. If you look at the map, and it's on our website, they really are around the island. Like, there's pretty much every area except the North Shore, I want to say. You'll see these dots. But there is a heavy concentration in these main thoroughfares. And like you were saying, these are expensive things. It's one thing to kind of write a story and say, hey, this is a problem. But, you know, the messy solution is can be very expensive, and it cuts to policy questions, you know, messy policy questions of ultimately, do we want to make these heavily trafficked areas, work better for pedestrians in reality? And what is the consequence? What is the cost? What does that mean for drivers who are going to have to, you know, maybe drive a little slower and not get as far as they are used to? So, yeah.
And a quick but perhaps unfair question, if for a driver, who has liability if a pedestrian is hit in what used to be a crosswalk but is no longer a crosswalk?
That's a really good question. The law states it's a crosswalk, so I don't know. Maybe perhaps the drivers, you know, the law being the law, you have to kind of be up on it. So
why do I think this is going to wind up in a court case someplace down the line? All right. Marcel Honoré, his story is online at civilbeat.org. Marcel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Bill.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat. Today, reporter Marcel Honoré.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kahilu Theater on Hawaii Island. Singer-songwriter Tiffany performs songs such as I Think We Are Alone Now, September 30th, kahilutheater.org.
The UN General Assembly always draws a lot of attention when world leaders gather there in the fall, and this week has been no exception. For reporters, the focus has ranged from President Trump in Ukraine to Boris Johnson in the British Parliament to the leader of Iran. One topic that hasn't gotten a lot of media attention this week is Kashmir. That's a disputed territory claimed by both India and Pakistan. Since the two countries underwent partition in 1947, violence has flared in the area from time to time, but this year has seen the highest number of deaths in the region in a decade. In early August, the government of India imposed a security lockdown in Kashmir, citing a terrorism threat from Pakistan. Several thousand Kashmiris have been detained in a move criticized by Human Rights Watch, among other groups. The Consul General of Pakistan in Los Angeles was recently in Hawaii, in part to draw attention to this issue. Abdul Jabbar Memon talked about past actions by the United Nations when it comes to Kashmir.
Since 1948 until now, there have been at least 14 resolutions which have been passed. Those are binding resolutions which have been passed by United Nations Security Council, that the fate of Kashmiris would be determined through impartial, transparent plebiscite, and right of self-determination will be given to them through that plebiscite as per the aspiration of the Kashmir. That implementation stage is still awaited. In the last 70 years, India has not been complying with the United Nations binding Security Council resolutions. So it's very unfortunate. When people talk about the Kashmir solution, I say solution has already been given there. It has been enshrined in the various UN resolutions given from time to time that India has to conduct a referendum, and through that referendum, the Kashmiris will determine their fate through their aspirations.
And that for an audience not familiar with the history and the context, knowing that it has been a long-running dispute, and yet this year now it has been dialed up to a different level.
Yes. So you know that this, the August 5, as you already mentioned in your opening remarks, on August 5, a unilateral decision was taken by the government of India by revoking Article 370A and 35A. Article 370A basically provides the autonomy to the Kashmir.
So that part of the Indian Constitution.
For the Indian Constitution. Mm-hmm. And this article is available only for Kashmir. It's for other princely mm-hmm. states as well. But it was a unilateral decision because Kashmir has been declared as a disputed territory by United Nations. So any unilateral decision by India is contravention of the international norms and international law. So since then, you know, there's a clampdown, curfew. They have converted this Kashmir in virtually an open-air jail. There are 12 million Muslims there. They are confined into their houses. They cannot go to their jobs. Kids cannot go to schools. Even they cannot perform their religious rituals. They were not allowed to offer their Eid al-Zuha, you know, a big festival of Muslims all over the world, to perform their prayers in their mosques. Patients cannot go to the hospitals. The hospitals are running out of the medicines. The doctors cannot go to there. It's, I think, a unique kind of violation of the human rights currently going on in Kashmir.
And something that, on the diplomatic front, for Pakistan and for India, both playing to an international audience and making a case about the situation.
Pakistan has been extending diplomatic, political, and moral support to the Kashmiris from the very first day and would be continuing to give the same support in future as well. Pakistan, you know, it was the first time, the last time Kashmir was discussed in Security Council in 1971, and it was after 50 years that recently it has been discussed as an informal consultations, mm-hmm. not it was a formally convened session, but they have stamped in a way that it's a disputed territory, and it has to be again, you know, that settled through those resolutions which have been passed by United Nations.
The United Nations General Assembly meets in New York. Is this going to come up?
We are pursuing it very actively on diplomatic channels. You know, our Prime Minister is visiting New York. Our Foreign Minister would be here. You know, our Foreign Minister was just a few days before in Geneva in the Human Rights. Even they have shown the concern on what's going on in Kashmir. We will definitely plead our case forcefully in United Nations General Assembly. And it's very crystal clear. It's not something which is, you know, it's an open secret that what India is doing is completely in violation of the international law.
There are other topics on Pakistan's diplomatic agenda. They include playing a potential role in Afghanistan in peace talks involving the United States and the Taliban.
First, let me explain that Pakistan really is interested to see Afghanistan a very stable, secure, and prosperous country. because it's bordering us, 760 kilometer border is with Afghanistan. So if Afghanistan is stable, Pakistan is stable because its fallout or spillover effect impacts us a lot than any other country. Pakistan has been facilitating this peace and reconciliation talk from the very first day, is assisting the reconciliation talks even today, and would be supporting all stakeholders in future as well. So on all levels, we are willing to extend any kind of support to any government or to any stakeholder which brings peace and stability in Afghanistan. So our role is very clear that we want to see that this Afghan crisis be settled through negotiation, and peace and reconciliation process is very important to bring peace in Afghanistan.
On a very different topic, Prime Minister Imran Khan, one of the initiatives of his government is to encourage tourism to Pakistan.
Well, you know that you have been in Pakistan and you have seen the northern areas, how beautiful they are. There has always been an issue of accessibility, and then, you know, this militancy and terrorism after 1979 when Russia invaded in Afghanistan. In 40 years, we have not been able to really look into this domain, that how we can promote tourism in Pakistan and how we can attract foreign tourists to Pakistan, because it's amazingly beautiful northern areas and entire Pakistan, and even cost-wise is very, you know, economical. So after, you know, this 40 years of turmoil and quagmire in Afghanistan, we have been able, our brave forces fought this terrorism and militants. Now we have been in a phase where we can really take the initiative of promoting tourism in my country. So I, even as a consul general, I have witnessed in my office that normally in the past, say, few years before, there was not a visa request from the American tourists. Now, but now I'm issuing at least 10, 15 visas every day to tourists, those who are going for mountaineering, who are going to the northern areas, and even investors. So it is some kind of, you know, that environment is available which is conducive for tourism as well for investment in Pakistan.
And safety?
There was a time when we used to have 4 suicide bombing incidents in 4 capitals of the Pakistan, and we used to carry 100 dead bodies on our shoulders and bury them. But fortunately now you will very rarely, seldom you will find any such incident. So I think we have maintained security, law and order situation in Pakistan now in a very comfortable zone. I cannot say that it has been immaculately maintained, but even if you are in New York, if you are at wrong time at wrong place, you will be in trouble. So that cannot be said that it's absolutely foolproof and all that. But it has been made to that extent that tourists, foreigners, even Pakistanis can live comfortably, travel without any hassle, without any problem now in Pakistan.
Thanks so much for coming in and spending some time with us.
Thank you very much. I'm so grateful.
Abdul Jabbar Mehmoon is the Consul General of Pakistan in Los Angeles. That is the conversation for today. Thanks for joining us right now. It's time to head back over to Pledge Central.